broadcast of the New York Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra, usually heard at this time, will be presented immediately following this special broadcast. This is Hyde Park, New York, and here we are gathered to witness the dedication of the new Franklin Roosevelt Library, the laying of the cornerstone ceremony, which is to start in just a few moments. On the platform, there stands the Honorable Frank C. Walker, who will preside at this ceremony this afternoon before the Gray Fieldstone Library, and the President of the United States will then lay the cornerstone. A few moments ago, the President arrived, and the little copper box was sealed, containing the things which are put into the cornerstone, and in a moment or two, the ceremony will begin. Excuse me. Among the speakers will be the Honorable Archibald MacLeish, the Librarian of Congress, and the Honorable R.D.W. Connor, the Archivist of the United States. The prayer will be delivered later by the Reverend Frank R. Wilson, and during the laying of the cornerstone, we shall give you a description of the library. In a moment or two, Mr. Walker will be ready to begin the ceremony.
Mr. President, and Mrs. Roosevelt, and friends, we are here today to lay the cornerstone of a new library building. Seemingly, this is just a happy and pleasant occasion, similar to many of its kind, unusual only in that it is graced by the presence of the President of the United States, his good wife and mother, and many of their good friends. This is more than that. The laying of this cornerstone tells to all America the foundation has been completed for the Franklin D. Roosevelt Library. This building, which is being erected on this site, will become the storehouse for the private papers of Franklin D. Roosevelt, citizen, state senator, assistant secretary of the Navy, governor of the state of New York, and president of the United States of America. This structure, now in its beginning, was conceived and planned by the great American historians and archivists of our generation. Its erection will come to pass because of our fine public-spirited citizens, many of whom are present here and now. And this is all made possible by the understanding, patriotism, and generosity of the President of the United States of America. Here will be maintained and preserved the most important archival material. Here, for the first time in our national history, the complete, unedited papers of a chief executive will be presented to the people during his lifetime in office. Presidential papers are the private accounting records of a sacred public trust. And I am wondering if, in giving them to the people, our president does not send them this message. I give you the records of my stewardship. Upon the successes and failures which you find here, build greater safeguards for the perpetuation of our American rights and a greater, more progressive government for our freedom-living people. To you, Mr. President, we are grateful. In our midst, we have a distinguished poet and great author who has recently become the Librarian of Congress. I present Mr. MacLeish, who will give you an appreciation of the library.
Mr. President, Mrs. Roosevelt, ladies and gentlemen, there are those who would say that the Librarian of Congress was an inappropriate speaker on this occasion. There are some, indeed, who would suggest that the stone he is helping to lay is not a cornerstone, but a stone, so far at least as concerns his dearest hopes, of an entirely different character. For the library which is to be built from this beginning is a library which will include in time all, or nearly all, the printed records and personal papers of a remarkable period in the history of this republic. Papers which the Library of Congress would be very pleased to have. With that view of my position here, I can sympathize but not agree. I can sympathize with the suggestion that the Library of Congress has lost what it would like to have, but I cannot agree that the loss is a disaster. The Library of Congress considers itself, and rightly considers itself, the depository of the American tradition, as that tradition is laid down in the manuscripts and books which make up the visible body of American history. It intends that its collection of these books and these manuscripts shall be as complete as love and industry can make them. It is, and will continue to be, an exceedingly acquisitive institution within this field. But even so, the Library of Congress cannot believe that the existence of a great collection of material on the New Deal at Hyde Park, or the existence of a great collection of material on the World War at Leland Stanford, is a defeat of all its hopes. There may have been a time when the deposit of essential materials in one library rather than another was a tragic loss. But if there ever was such a time, it was a time which has long since ended. Modern practices of interlibrary loans and modern techniques of photoduplication make the treasures of any American library available to scholars working in any other. The unit for scholarly purposes, in other words, is no longer the individual library, but libraries as a whole. And the acquisitiveness of librarians changes, or ought to change, accordingly. Librarians no longer torture themselves with thoughts of an imaginary and impossible completeness which no library ever has attained or ever will. They no longer encourage in themselves those jealousies of the collector which regard not the usefulness of the thing possessed, but the fact of its possession. They consider other and more generous purposes. They consider how the total resources of all the libraries of this republic can be made adequate to the needs of American scholarship. They consider how essential materials of scholarship, now walled off behind the new Chinese wall of state-taught ignorance, state-taught intolerance, and state-taught hate, can be saved for the free inquiry of scholars in those countries where scholars are still free. They consider how American libraries can work together to these ends. In the shadow of questions such as these, questions which will not wait indefinitely for an answer, there is little room to grow indignant because a given body of material, however important, is deposited in the state of New York rather than in the District of Columbia. But there is also another and perhaps a better reason why the Library of Congress has been able to reconcile itself to the laying of this stone. The material which is to be deposited here is material which any custodian of records, any keeper of books, would wish, if he could, to set apart as a single and separate collection, no matter where it was placed or in what company. It is material which forms, by the necessities of its nature, a single and homogeneous whole, and material which no librarian would treat in any other manner. I do not refer to the fact only that this material has a chronological unity of its own, nor to the more impressive fact that it has a human center and a human symmetry. The records of a given sequence of years may be altogether lacking in singleness, and the records of a given man, however famous, may be incoherent and chaotic. What distinguishes these papers is the fact that they are not merely the papers written in a particular sequence of years, nor the papers written by and to and about a particular man, but the papers of a time. The papers which speak of and speak for, and therefore recreate a time which the minds and memories of men can recognize. Scholars talk loosely and easily of times and ages and eras, but the common speech of the people does not abuse these words. In the common speech of the people, the ages and the eras and the times are the periods of years which have a definite and recognizable human pattern. They are the periods of years in which the human spirit, the human will to alter the world and recreate it, compels the shapelessness of time to take on meaning. They are sometimes periods of misery and misfortune. They are more often periods of aspiration and will. But they are always periods of life, periods in which the strong and restless human life breaks off the custom and compels the world to be the world that men are capable of imagining, not the world that men accepted in the past. The records which will be collected here are the records in this precise and common sense of an era and of a time. They are the records of a period in which the strong and restless life of the American people refused to accept the world as it had been and demanded that the world become the world their wishing could imagine. They are the records of the speaking and the action of the man who, more than any other man, has been the actor and the speaker of this time. the man who refused in the name of his generation to continue to accept what was no longer acceptable, the man who demanded for his generation what his generation had the courage to expect. As such, they have the unity which history remembers and even living men can see. They belong by themselves, here in this river country, on the land from which they came.
I know of no one who has a better understanding or finer conception of the reasons that bring us here today than the learned historian and archivist who will guide the destinies and become the director of this library. I present to you Dr. Connor, the National Archivist.
Mr. President, Mrs. Roosevelt, ladies and gentlemen, Franklin D. Roosevelt is the nation's answer to the historian's prayer. As a student of history, he has a clear understanding of the role of the statesman in the life of a nation. As a statesman, he has an equally clear understanding of the role of the historian. The statesman directs events. The historian interprets them. Mr. Roosevelt understands that it is the statesman's obligation to supply the historian with the records that constitute the raw materials of history. Ordinarily, it is impossible for a man to forecast his own place in history, or to know with any degree of certitude whether the record of his own career will ever be of any historical value. One is safe in saying, however, that any man who has served as the chief magistrate of a great nation becomes ipso facto a historical figure, and the records of his life and career will be indispensable sources for the study of the nation's history. The papers of American presidents, therefore, are source materials of the highest value for the American historian. Yet, there are no White House archives. Beginning with Washington, our presidents have considered their presidential papers as their personal property, and each outgoing president has made a clean sweep of the file rooms of the executive mansion. Nobody has ever seriously questioned their right to do so. Although the papers of presidents are not official records, they lose nothing in historical value by that fact. Nor does that fact lessen the moral, if not the legal, obligation of their owners to preserve them for the benefit of the nation. But this obligation entails a financial burden that few ex-presidents or their heirs have been able to meet at their own expense. The results have been disastrous. Neglect, ignorance, fire, and other hazards have taken their toll. The papers of a few presidents have disappeared altogether. Of some others, only fragments remain. Still others are privately owned and practically inaccessible to historians. Portions of the papers of 9 presidents have been preserved, because their thrifty heirs sold them to the government for sums ranging from $500 to $55,000. Mr. Roosevelt was fully aware of these conditions when he came to consider the ultimate disposition of his own papers. Several considerations entered into his final decision. Perhaps he was appalled at the flood of records of all kinds that pours daily into his office. Whereas his immediate predecessor received an average of some 400 letters a day, President Roosevelt has been deluged with a daily average of upward of 4,000, a fact in itself indicative of the development of our American democracy. We do not need to await the appearance of some future Bancroft to tell us that the period covered by Mr. Roosevelt's administrations is a significant era in American history, or that his papers will be indispensable sources for the study of this period for generations to come. Even the congressman who said that President Roosevelt's papers should be preserved so that future presidents could learn from them how not to run the government, unintentionally gave them a high evaluation as historical source materials. It must be evident, therefore, that the volume of the president's papers is too great for them to be adequately preserved and administered as a private collection, and too important to the nation to justify their being held in private custody. Such were some of the considerations that inspired the president's plan to carve out of his Hyde Park estate this beautiful 16-acre lot, to have erected thereon with private funds a modern fireproof building as a permanent repository for his historical material, and to donate the whole as a completed project to the nation to be maintained by the government for the benefit of the American people. Here, for the first time in our history, through the generosity of Franklin D. Roosevelt and his friends and associates, will be deposited and preserved under federal control and for the use of the public an extensive and invaluable collection of the papers and other historical materials of the President of the United States relating to a specific period of American history. It is this fact that gives significance to these ceremonies in which we are participating.
In keeping with the solemnity of this occasion, Reverend Frank R. Wilson, rector of St. James Episcopal Church of Hyde Park, will offer prayer. Dr. Wilson.
Let us pray. Our help is in the name of the Lord, who hath made heaven and earth. O Lord, hear our prayer. We glorify thy name, our God, whom our fathers have declared to be the one foundation and cornerstone of our national life. Our faith also is in thee, who art the beginning, the increase, and the consummation of every good work undertaken in thy name. Bless what we do now in laying this cornerstone, that this work may be brought to a happy conclusion, and the desires of thy servants be fulfilled. Shield the workmen in their work, and safeguard them from all injury. And so, with faith in thee, our God, we lay this stone in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Mr. Walker, my neighbors and friends, half a century ago, a small boy took a special delight in climbing an old tree, now unhappily gone, to pick and eat ripe sickle pears. That is about 100 feet to the west of where I am standing now. And just to the north, he used to lie flat between the strawberry rows and eat sun-warm strawberries, the best in the world. And in the spring of the year, in hip rubber boots, he sailed his first toy boats in the surface water formed by the melting snow. In the summer, with his dogs, he dug into woodchuck holes in this same field. And some of you are standing right on top of those holes at this minute. Indeed, the descendants of those same woodchucks still inhabit this field, and I hope that under the auspices of the National Archivist that they will continue to do so for all time. It has therefore been my very personal hope that this library and the use of it by scholars and visitors will come to be an integral part of a country scene which the hand of man has not changed very greatly since the days of the Indians who dwelt here 300 years ago. We know, for example, we know from simple deduction that these fields were cultivated by the first inhabitants of America. For the oak trees in these fields were striplings 3 centuries ago and grew up in open fields, as is proved to us by their wide-spreading lower branches. Therefore, they grew up in open spaces, and the only open spaces in Dutchess County were the cornfields of the Indians. Yes, this is a peaceful countryside, and it seems appropriate in this November of 1939, in this time of strife, that we should dedicate the library to the spirit of peace, peace for the United States, and soon, we hope, peace for the world itself. At the same time, we can express the thought that those in the days to come who seek to learn from contemporaneous documents the history of our time will gain a less superficial and more intimate and accurate view of the aspirations and purposes of all kinds of Americans who have been living in these times. Of the papers which will come to rest here, I personally attach less importance to the documents of those who have occupied high public or private office than I do to the spontaneous letters which have come to me and my family and my associates from men, from women, and from children in every part of the United States, telling me of their conditions, of their problems, and giving me their opinions. To you who have come here today to take part in the laying of the cornerstone, you who have contributed so greatly to the building of the library, and to you who have also helped, but who could not be present, I give my appreciation and thanks. And I add to my very sincere thanks to all the workmen and the foremen who have made possible this splendid beginning of this building. It is an adequate building. It is going to be a wholly adequate building. And it will be turned over, as you know, to the government of the United States next summer without any cost whatsoever to the taxpayers of the country. During the following year, the manuscripts, the letters, the books, the pictures, and the models will be placed in their appropriate settings, and the collections will be ready for public inspection and use, we hope, by the spring of 1941. And may I add, in order that my good friends of the press will have something to write about tomorrow, that I hope they will give due interpretation to the expression of my hope that when we open the building to the public, it will be a fine day. all of you who have been so generous in making this library possible. All of my friends and associates who have given so greatly of their time and their interest in the planning of the work. All of you will join me, I know, in feeling well rewarded if for generations to come, the people of the United States approve our planning and believe that the life of our nation has been thereby enriched.
The President of the United States has just concluded his address here on his Hyde Park estate at the laying of the cornerstone of the new Franklin Roosevelt Library. Perhaps you heard him shouting to the little crowd of neighbors and distinguished officials. The President said, "Now I'm going to work." And then the Honorable Frank C. Walker, who was presiding at the ceremony, announced over the loudspeaker system that the President will now lay the cornerstone. The President now moves north off the wooden speaker's platform to the little corner of the north wing of this building, which is finished to lay the cornerstone. As we told you before, when the President drove up, he drove his own automobile, incidentally, sitting at the wheel of a touring car with the top down. When the President drove up, the articles were placed in the little copper box and sealed, and now it is time for the President to perform the ceremony of laying the cornerstone. The President, in a tweed suit, a brown tweed suit with an Oxford gray overcoat on it, hatless, has the trowel in his hand, and now, in a jam of photographers, press representatives, and distinguished officials who have come here to witness this ceremony, he is wielding the trowel. A flashlight pops over there behind the President's head, and the pictures are being taken as the President lays the cornerstone. Of course, there's not really much action in laying a cornerstone. It's a symbolic act, and the workman must finish off the business, which is always begun by the distinguished guest, in this case, the President of the United States himself. This ceremony is the laying of the cornerstone of the new Franklin Roosevelt Library, which will contain some 6 million documents covering the President's career from the time that he was a state senator from the state of New York. The building is not finished. There are red lead-painted steel girders poking up into the sky, but a couple of walls of native gray fieldstone are finished, and it was with the background of one of these gray fieldstone walls that this ceremony this afternoon was held. Mrs. Roosevelt, also hatless, wearing a brown tweed coat, is moving off the platform, and now the President's mother, in a black velvet coat and black velvet hat, stops to chat a moment with the Reverend Frank R. Wilson, the rector of St. James's Episcopal Church here in Hyde Park, the church which the President attends when he is at his mother's home on this Hyde Park estate. This little tract is composed of 16 acres. It was a part of the President's mother's estate. The President's mother deeded the estate to the President, and he in turn gave it to the government of the United States. There's an apple orchard just to the north of here. The apple orchard will continue to be cultivated because the land will be worked, will be cultivated to prevent any possibility of erosion. As the President mentioned, those two ancient oak trees which stand just next to the library this afternoon, gaunt and bare without any leaves on them, are being used by press photographers and by newsreel cameramen as points of vantage. The President says, "Isn't it lovely?" And he holds up in the air in his right hand the trowel with an ivory handle and with a solid gold blade. It's engraved, but of course it's too far off to see the engraving. The photographers now really are clustering around to get a picture of the President holding the trowel aloft just before he completes the work of spreading a bit of the cement on the cornerstone. Inside the box are a good many articles, which of course it's impossible to tell you all of because of a lack of time, but among other things, there is a copy of the program of this cornerstone ceremony at which you've been a witness today, a pamphlet entitled "The Background and Purposes of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Library, Incorporated," and a list of the honorary speakers. That slight roar in the background was a small airplane which flew low overhead, apparently either taking pictures or merely sightseeing. And so, as the photographers continue to take their pictures and make their records, which you will see tomorrow, of this cornerstone laying, our description shall come to an end here in Hyde Park, New York. We heard, among others, this afternoon an address by the Honorable Archibald MacLeish, who is the Librarian of Congress of the United States. The ceremony was attended by a good many of the townspeople and neighbors of the president here at Hyde Park, as well as a good many distinguished visitors who came up from Washington, D.C. It is, of course, impossible to tell you all of them, but standing right here in this crowd is Paul V. McNutt of Indiana and District of Columbia Commissioner George Allen. Of course, as I say, to tell you all those that we see in this little gathering, which is an informal and typically Hyde Park country gathering, to tell you the names of all of them would be impossible. And so this concludes the broadcast in connection with the dedication of the Hyde Park Library. This is Bob Trout speaking in Hyde Park. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.